From KPFK Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The 2021 Golden Globes Awards ceremony featured a big win for filmmaker Chloe Zhao, who won Best Director and whose film Nomadland won Best Picture in the drama category. The film is a sparsely shot and artistically fictionalized feature based on a non-fiction book of the same name by writer Jessica Bruder. There's already plenty of Oscar buzz around the film. Nomadland, the book, shines a light on a little-known but growing trend in the U.S. labor force, work campers, who are mostly American retirees who find they cannot make ends meet and pay their rent or mortgages on their Social Security and pension checks. So they live life on the road in RVs and campers, driving to where the work is and camping overnight in parking lots and campgrounds. But Nomadland, the film, focuses on two characters, both of whom have excellent options for living comfortable middle-class lives in homes offered by close relatives. One of the characters takes the option and the other does not, giving the impression that nomadic existence is a personal choice made by retired workers rather than a social symptom of our race-to-the-bottom economy. While the book is an indictment of Amazon's impact on the economy, the film barely features the retailer. And when it does so in a positive light. Today, we'll re-air our interview with writer Jessica Bruder about her book, Nomadland. Jessica is an award-winning journalist whose work focuses on subcultures and the dark corners of the economy. She teaches at Columbia School of Journalism. Her other book was Burning Book, A Visual History of Burning Man. And she's also a producer on the film of the same name as her book, Nomadland.
Thanks for having me, Sonali.
So I had confessed I'd never heard of this. And anyone who's gone camping, you know, knows you see a lot of retirees in RVs and you might assume they're vacationing like everybody else. But in fact, many of them might very well be part of this group of Americans calling themselves work campers. What do you attribute this trend to? How do you link it to our changing economy?
Oh, there's so many factors. You already mentioned the gig economy and the fact that so many people are becoming independent contractors, which is essentially very convenient for employers and a way to shear off benefits. We're also seeing so many of the people I wrote about were at or nearing retirement age. Retirement finance in America is a mess. Back in the day, people got pensions. In the 80s, that transferred more to 401ks. These were marketed as instruments of financial freedom, but really just shifted the risk from the employer's shoulders to the workers. We've got so many people who are really suffering from the fact that minimum wage has been stuck at $7.25 an hour federally for a long time. We have increasing housing costs. We've got folks who lost it all in the Great Recession, and particularly if you're older and your nest egg was your housing equity or you had something saved away that you lost in the market, you don't have time to make that up. So it's really kind of a perfect storm in terms of finance, and it's something employers are definitely seeing an advantage in, and there are just a lot of people out on the road right now.
So many of these folks, if they have a home, sell it, presumably so that they don't have to keep paying mortgage. Maybe they have a nest egg to buy an RV, or if they were renting, now they don't have to pay rent every month. Doesn't that make them homeless?
They prefer to call themselves houseless. There is such a stigma in this country against the word homeless. It means so much more than the word literally means. It's really a way of kind of creating a caste system, an us and them system. And many of these people, they come from all sorts of different backgrounds. I interviewed one gentleman who was the head of product development for McDonald's in the 70s. I know other people who were stuck in low-wage jobs all their lives. But one thing they have in common is they don't want to be seen as stigmatized. And who can blame them? So most of them refer to themselves as houseless rather than homeless. The vehicle is the home. It's the transportation and it's the shelter. So that's the word that has been coined to describe them.
Let's humanize the story a little bit more, as you do in your book. Tell us about Linda May. She's one of the people that you profile in your book. She calls her house, which is her camper, the squeeze-in. Who is Linda May? What is her story?
Yeah, Linda May is an incredibly resilient woman in her 60s who has done every job known to humankind, it seems, from being a cocktail waitress to working in insurance to being a general contractor, a long-haul truck driver. I think she once defeathered quails at a hunting lodge. I mean, Linda has done it, if it's a job you can think of. But so many of those jobs were low-wage work, and like so many people now, Linda never had a job that involved some sort of pension. So basically, Linda found herself working another low-wage job at a Home Depot. She had been a project manager for Home Depot before, taking advantage of her skills in as a general contractor, but seemed to encounter some ageism in the workforce, where suddenly she's working the register, she's not getting enough hours, and those skills she's got, that lifetime of knowledge, is not really being tapped. In addition, she realized that her Social Security checks were only going to amount to, I think, just under $500 a month, not enough to pay the rent in this little manufactured housing park she was living in a very small place. And she kind of realized that she was going to be hand to mouth and behind that register at Home Depot till the day she died, just scraping for hours, and wanted to try to find something different. She had a long-term dream of homesteading, buying a little piece of land and building a sustainable, upcycled home on it. And that's how Linda ended up out on the road working some pretty tough jobs. She bought a really inexpensive RV, later went even smaller scale with a trailer that measured 10 feet inside that she called the squeeze in because it's 5'3" in terms of its height, and Linda's 5'2", so she really just fits in there. Yeah, so basically Linda got out on the road. She wanted to try to build a bridge between this perpetual low wage work that she would be stuck in till the day she died, and having some sort of homestead where she could not only live and take care of herself, but hopefully create something for the future and her grandchildren.
So, with Linda May and the other folks that you talk to, do you get the sense that people who engage in this lifestyle, and it's not a chosen lifestyle, but who are in this way I mean, I suppose it is to some extent chosen, but do they view it as a temporary thing, a means to an end? Are they saving up for a permanent house elsewhere, or do many of them view this as their existence till they die?
Linda saw it as a means to an end, but actually, I think she was a bit of an anomaly in that regard because many of the people I met really didn't have a long-term plan and did not anticipate getting absorbed back into traditional housing, which is interesting because when you look at there were scads of people on the road after the Depression in the outfall of that, and everybody anticipated that they'd kind of go back into the middle class and be reabsorbed. And I just see a lot of people right now who look at the economy, they look at the environment, they don't really see the status quo returning for our culture. And for that reason, they see this as kind of a permanent transition themselves.
Let's talk about Amazon and Camper Force. And presumably, Amazon isn't the only company taking advantage of retirees. Maybe they're the one of the few that's formalized it. What is Camper Force, and how does Amazon sell itself to these retirees?
Sure. So Camper Force is a program that began, didn't have a name yet when it began, but it began in the months following the housing crash in 2008.
Oh,
And
wow. So it's been around for that long?
it's been around for that long, but growing. And again, started right after the housing crash when Amazon has had a challenge long term in terms of stocking, basically getting enough warm bodies into the warehouse to fill orders during the busy commercial bonanza that is the months leading up to Christmas. So this was one way, I believe it was a temp agency that originally said, hey, maybe we could bring in some RVers. And the program kind of took off from there. Amazon contracts with RV parks around some of its warehouses and basically puts the RVers there. You know, they show up with everything they need, their home on wheels. They do this work, 10-hour plus shifts, often standing on concrete the whole time, which is some pretty hard work on older bodies. I know a lot of people who have gotten repetitive stress injuries doing this kind of work. And they're basically plug and play labor. They show up for the months leading to Christmas. And when Amazon doesn't need them anymore and the demand falls off a bit, they pack up and drive their homes away and they're gone.
And presumably, if they get injured on the job, Amazon doesn't see itself responsible?
In the cases where I've seen where somebody was injured on the job, it's not like they get paid time off or whatever. I mean, it's they do have, an in-house medical service called AmCare. But it's interesting because you can't bring your cell phone into a warehouse, and they've got this in-house kind of first aid agency. So in a weird way, it keeps everything really contained in terms of what information gets to the outside world, who actually will go receive care someone else, things that will get reported.
Wow.
So yeah, it's kind of a complicated ecosystem.
Presumably, this is very lucrative for companies like Amazon, or they wouldn't have such programs. They like this kind of a workforce, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really can-do, positive workforce. These are people who are often quite grateful for the mainstream workplace. I'm really happy somebody will hire them. Another very popular, or at least widespread, job is camp hosting, often in national parks. This is like a job where you're cleaning the toilets three times a day, you're checking people in, you're shoveling out fire pits. It's a
in
job
exchange for free campsites?
For a free campsite, mm-hmm. and sometimes a wage, and sometimes not. So often these jobs are marketed to potential workers as ways to really have a great time. I kind of refer to this as the weaponization of positive psychology, because often these are very difficult physical jobs at a rather low wage. And in some cases, they get marketed as fun, something that will inspire camaraderie. Amazon had a newsletter they sent out with the headline, Camper Force, the Value of Friendship. I see camp hosts, basically concessionaires who are seeking to hire camp hosts, issuing recruiting brochures that say, you know, you get paid to go camping and just talk about how fun the job is. And often these jobs are quite physical and challenging. And I think what the employers recognize is that this is a really can-do population. They show up, they're glad for the jobs they work, and they don't ask for much. And they definitely play into that when seeking workers.
And how much of it is also based on the psychology of the people who are working? Because as you were saying earlier, these are not people who want to see themselves as homeless. There's, I'm sure, a serious issue of pride and dignity involved. And to mask one's desperation, one sometimes puts on a brave face and convinces oneself and everyone around you that that you're choosing this lifestyle as a lifestyle.
These issues run really deep, and I'm glad you brought it up, because one of the first things people told me when I met them often was, I'm doing this by choice. Mm. And typically when that came up, I hadn't even asked. It was kind of a preemptive suggestion. But after you spend, you know, more than a week with somebody, the story would typically get more nuanced. That was when I would hear about the foreclosure, the medical debt, the divorce, the challenging financial circumstances that made this, what's being referred to as a choice, the best option. So I kind of feel like choice is a way, it's almost like an amulet people hold for their own agency, because nobody wants to be a victim. And that's something I have a lot of respect for.
Yeah.
By the same token, I think a lot of outsiders expect that this population would be walking around in sackcloth and ashes and bemoaning their lot. And they're not. They're a tough, resilient, creative bunch. I just worry that sometimes that makes them ripe for exploitation by employers.
Right. And can they, I mean, are they actually making it? Because it's not free to live on the road. You're paying for gas, you're paying for campsite fees where they do charge. You still have to find a way to shower someplace, right? And also, what about the sort of practical aspects of it? Presumably, many of these people are getting their social security checks in the mail, but if you're moving around, how do you get access to your mail, et cetera?
Yeah, okay, that's a lot of questions.
So yeah, let's start with the financial aspects first. Are they actually able to make it financially?
Make it is a complicated way to put it. People are super, super ingenious about low-budget living solutions on the road. For example, folks like to use Planet Fitness as the equivalent of a nationwide shower pass.
Huh.
I've seen that quite a bit. You talked about how people sometimes do pay for camping. Frequently, folks will do what they call boondocking, which is camping way off the grid without hookups. They can do that for very little money or for free. And other people will do what they call stealth camping, which is basically just trying to go unnoticed, parked in a more urban area. Honestly, that often involves fear of getting the knock, which is a police officer rousting you and saying it's time to move on. But these are ways that people keep their costs pretty close to the bone.
Wow. And then the practical aspects of it. I mean, presumably they haven't sold everything on off in their life. Some of them are probably storing the stuff of their old life elsewhere. How are they picking up checks?
Yeah, so it's really difficult not to have a permanent home. And the
Yeah, I
more
mean,
time.
how are you getting health care, especially as an older person?
A lot of people aren't, frankly. I mean, some of them meet the poverty exemption, so they're not paying into a pool. And others, frankly, are domiciled, which is legally registered in states where the health care, even under ACA, wouldn't be portable. So a lot of things that might be solutions for other people, frankly, don't work for them. Some financial things can be done digitally, including, I believe, Social Security.
I
So
see.
that works. But everybody has to have a legal address for a driver's license, for example. That's critical to this population, for taxes, for jury service. So people will use family members' addresses. They'll sign up with mail forwarding services. And there are some areas, including, I believe it's South Dakota, where if you show up with a receipt from one night stay at a motel, you can become a resident. So there are actually some areas that cater to having people sign up as residents of their states, even though they know they're full-time mobile.
What are the demographics of this group? And I know that's probably a question whose answer is changing a little bit, but do you have a general sense of, for example, are these mostly retirees or are younger people sort of trying to get in on this as well? And are we seeing people of all races or is it largely one race over another?
So the demographics, this is really a demographer's nightmare. Basically, in terms of tracking people, obviously everybody kind of blends in with the house population in terms of having a permanent address. So again, anything I have is really anecdotal. I would guess that the population we're talking about conservatively is in the tens of thousands or more. I have met a bunch of younger people on the road. And a lot of them are dealing with the same bad economy that older people are. They are dealing with student debt. They don't want to go to college because they don't want to go into debt. They don't want to basically go out into a workforce where the jobs are so low wage, where we're stuck with a federal minimum wage of $7.25 an hour. So a lot of them are just trying to live a bit differently as well. In terms of race, I noticed that the population, basically in the subculture, I kept asking myself, why is this so white? I mean, it wasn't completely homogenous in terms of if we look at all the axes of diversity. I saw trans people out there. There was a guy who I spent a lot of time with who I really liked who was showing me how he pointed his van to orient it for the call to prayer because he's a Muslim and he has an app that allows him to point it towards
Wow.
Mecca. So he's already, he's ready to go when the call to prayer comes. But a lot of the people I met were not people of color. And I wondered about that for a long time. I was like, is there some selection bias here? Am I not looking in the right places? And, I started looking at the photographs of people working at Camper Force for Amazon. And those photos were all white too. And people were actually talking about this online, saying, why is this so white? And one of the things that I could glean is you don't think of a certain degree of privilege accruing to this low-income group, but it does because it's funny, being out on the road, when I was writing the book and reporting it, it was before the Trumpocalypse, but oh my goodness, every day there was a headline about an unarmed African American, typically male, getting shot in a vehicle. So just the issues of traveling when you're super, super vulnerable because you may be economically profiled when you're living out of a vehicle, combined with the aspects of racial profiling, create a situation that goes from difficult to pretty untenable. So that was one of the reasons I figured it might have been a pretty white demographic.
Wow, it's amazing. So many stories embedded in this one. Is this community that is becoming more visible? I mean, when Trump got elected, he did so largely making the case that white workers were being left behind. And there is some truth to that, of course. But I don't know if he was talking about or he or the people that surround him have talked about or acknowledged this growing subculture that their economy today is so broken that you have growing numbers of people choosing to be houseless, and becoming nomads just to go to where the work is.
Yeah, and I don't think it's funny after the election, I think it was just a big wake-up call for a lot of us on the coasts and a lot of media saying, kind of, where are the angry white people, frankly? By and large, these people, I don't think, are those people. This demographic of people were saying, who are the people who are so fed up that they want the outsider, that they feel shafted? The people I met are really spending a lot of their time getting by and trying to find a way to make it work. Some of them are kind of what I call post-political, in that they really just don't have a lot of faith in political solutions. They didn't think that the cavalry was coming to help them before Trump. They don't think Trump represents that cavalry now. And while many of them have all sorts of different opinions in terms of just, you know, political philosophy, I met people on the left and on the right and a fairly deep dash of libertarianism. I think a lot of people just really don't have a lot of confidence in the political system at all to change things for them, and have kind of opted out in that way as well.
In your book, Nomadland, in addition to the people that you're profiling and talking to, you also examine the places where they gather. Quartzsite, Arizona, a place named Needles, California. Tell us about what characterizes these spaces. Are they towns that are sort of blighted and gearing their economy towards trying to attract RV campers? Or were they always places where campers gathered? What do these spaces look and feel like, which I suppose are the few places where you do have some sort of something standing still as opposed to the people who come and go?
Sure. Quartzsite's really the big one, and it's kind of a fascinating place. It is very, very hot in the summer in Quartzsite. Triple-digit temperatures, tough living. The rattlesnakes come out. Not a great time for camping.
I mean, I have to confess, it kind of looks like a refugee camp in Syria or outside of Syrians, you know, in Turkey, maybe.
National Geographic once referred to it as America's largest parking lot.
Wow.
And the weirdest thing, well, it's interesting. So they're just huge areas of public land out there. It's federal desert managed by the BLM. There are areas where
Bureau of Land Management.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sorry, the Bureau of Land Management. And there are areas where people can camp up to 2 weeks for free, then they have to move another 25 miles. And there are areas where you can buy a pass for the season that's pretty inexpensive. So it's become a very popular place to go. I think Quartzsite had a heyday, and there were tons and tons of the more well-heeled RV crowd going out there. There are still, you know, just dozens of RV parks there, but most of the people I met forgo those altogether to live much more cheaply off the land and to gather. But you do see a whole bunch of different economic stripes out there. You see people who part-time live on the road in very expensive motorhomes, and then you see people living out of tents and people, you know, I met some guys who referred to themselves as bicycle tramps. You know, there's a pretty active soup kitchen there. There are just a lot of people who come into town following the weather and the fact that it's affordable and essentially make camp there for that part of the year.
Well, Jessica, aside from the Amazon camper force demand every December, where else are people finding work? I imagine that it may not be easy to come by work. Do Linda May and some of the other people you profiled have times when they don't know when they're going to work next? How hand-to-mouth is their existence?
Absolutely. And a lot of people go on unemployment between jobs. Mm. It's the way they make it. But it's shocking how many employers there are. I mean, I remember talking to Linda and she was saying, you know, when you're in the mainstream workforce and you're looking for a job, it's really hard. And then suddenly when you enter this world, you go online and there are just tons and tons of jobs and literally thousands of employers.
Presumably very low pay though, right?
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct. And tricky and not always so good on aging bodies. I mean, we talked about campground hosts, we talked about Amazon, but there's an adventure park there's a theme park in Iowa called Adventureland that's been hiring work campers for years. And in the summer of 2016, a belt started up early on a ride, and a gentleman who was a retired pastor and postal carrier got killed. These are very physical jobs. So there are lots of them, but I don't know that they're the kind of job you really want to be relying on.
I mean, I wonder, is this the future? Is this what neoliberal capitalism wants American future to be? You know, if you live in one place, you're driving for Uber, or you're moving around looking for work at Amazon, that everybody has this driftless existence that's dependent on the whims of corporate demands and is in favor of corporate bottom lines. It's a depressing future to think about.
It's really hard to think about. It's funny because I'm visiting the Bay Area right now, and one of the gentlemen in the book, he was a San Francisco taxi driver for many years, got pushed out by Uber. His medallion was completely devalued, and there went his retirement. I met other people who were pushed out of Sunnyvale when their low-income housing was obliterated by luxury condos. And they were living in a van, and one of them had breast cancer and has since succumbed to it, and they never really got out of the van. So,
I mean,
yeah,
and
it's really.
I suppose I should sort of temper what I said, because I don't want to give the impression that I'm sort of feeling sorry for this whole group of people and that it's a terrible existence. And as you said, a lot of people feel like they've chosen this lifestyle, but it's sad to think that increasingly people are being driven into this rather than actually completely, you know, choosing this over a variety of options. It would be one thing if there were a variety of options, you know, many of which involved living in one place in one's own house, and still one chose to be on the road because it's a romantic existence. But that's not really the case here.
Yeah, I think the romance dries up a bit, and I like to describe this to people in terms of a favorite Rebecca Solnit book of mine called A Paradise Built in Hell, where she talks about these incredible micro utopias that grow in the wake of natural disasters. I see the economy as an unnatural or human-made disaster, and the fact that these micro utopias of incredibly resilient people looking out for each other, the fact that those have grown out of this huge disaster doesn't mean we'd will the disaster on anybody or that we wouldn't wish people to have more choices.
Right. I mean, what people end up making of their situation shouldn't be a reason for the disasters in the first place, or shouldn't be an
Absolutely.
excuse for them. I've been speaking with Jessica Bruder, award-winning journalist whose work focuses on subcultures and the dark corners of the economy. She teaches at Columbia School of Journalism. Her books include Burning Book, A Visual History of Burning Man, and the book we've just been discussing, Nomadland, Surviving America in the 21st Century. Bruder is also a producer on the film of the same name as her book. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify.